Hello, and welcome to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward. Today, I'll continue reading from the July 2026 issue. I'll begin by picking up where I left off last time. The article is titled The Spirit of the Age by Thomas Frank and deals with patriotism and nostalgia. Nostalgia is usually a kind of dissatisfaction with the present or a backlash against excessive change. What makes this particular species of perpetual nostalgia so powerful, however, is that it has it both ways. It sees utopia in the past, but it is also enthusiastic about the American doctrine of technological advancement. This might sound counterintuitive, maybe impossible. Progress, as it is defined nowadays, ruthlessly deletes industries and traditions and makes redundant whatever it is you learned to do when you were in school. Progress is the permanent revolution of the marketplace, at war not only with the past, but with everything that currently exists. It is nostalgia's mirror opposite. There's nothing less conservative than capitalism, so itchy for the new, wrote the historian Gary Wills in his 1987 book, Reagan's America. And yet for Reagan, the two visions were completely intertwined, one and the same, progress and nostalgia, the future and the past, the coming space age, and a gauzy dream of a Midwestern town circa 1900. One sees further traces of this peculiar coupling, Wills points out, in the work of people like Walt Disney and Henry Ford, but it was Reagan who made it into a political doctrine. Progress is our most important product, ran the slogan of General Electric in the days when Reagan was the star of its television programs and advertisements. Back then, Reagan lived in a suburban home in California that GE filled with the latest in ambient lighting and kitchen appliances. The House of the Future, it was called, a curious place for the embodiment of American nostalgia to dwell. But for Reagan, it all came together seamlessly. Small towns and high tech, memories of old Hollywood, and a future so glorious it was untethered from material reality. In the new economy, human invention increasingly makes physical resources obsolete, the former GE pitchman would go on to say in a speech at Moscow State University in 1988. We're breaking through the material conditions of existence to a world where man creates his own destiny. He was referring to advances in microchips and satellites. But as America moved ahead, the president claimed we were also returning to the age-old wisdom of our culture, a wisdom contained in the book of Genesis in the Bible. In the beginning was the Spirit, and it was from the Spirit that the material abundance of creation issued forth. One hardly expects similar eloquence from Donald Trump, but even for this man who believes America reached its zenith in the late 1800s, the technological future still beckons. The Republican platform for 2024, a consummate Trumpian document, was dedicated to the forgotten men and women of America, and it opened with a lachrymose invocation of American greatness prostrate under the iron heel of liberalism. It was the familiar nostalgic pattern, decline and renewal all over again. The platform then went on to declare Trump's intention to champion innovation by deregulating cryptocurrency and artificial intelligence. Since then, Trump has proven himself fully versed in the cliches of bold futurity, describing the new frontier of scientific discovery that's ahead of us, defined by transformative technologies such as artificial intelligence. The road from Betsy Ross flags to AI slop may be winding, but it is exceedingly well-traveled. The long triumph of what we call conservatism has clearly been bound up with this strange dialectic, this combination of nostalgia and its opposite. Past greatness plus future greatness, interrupted only by the degraded liberal present. It's a funny thing, though. These days really are a time of danger and degradation, of bigotry and war. And it's all due to the politics I have been describing. In these circumstances, it is tempting to dismiss nostalgia itself, to declare the past to be nothing more than the stupid and brutish present in embryo, a place of wickedness, sin, and guilt. But a wiser course might be to emphasize a kind of counter-nostalgia, reclaiming a mythic past for the forces of tolerance and democratic generosity. After all, the half-forgotten dreams of the long-ago liberals sound pretty good these days. Progress that includes everyone, freedom from domineering corporate power, a universal middle class, clean government, sanity. Remember, the heroic symbols that Ronald Reagan deployed so effectively were swiped from liberalism's salad days in the 30s and 40s. Surely, the trick can be played the other way around. Next up is an essay titled Chekhov's Gun by Vasily Grossman from the Front Line, which was published last month by New York Review Books, translated from the Russian by Robert Chandler and Elizabeth Chandler. Anatoly Chekhov is going on 20. His life has not been a happy one. The son of a worker at a chemical factory, he has a clear mind, a warm heart, and unusual talents. He has always worshipped books, adored geography, and dreamed of travel. And he has always been much liked by his comrades and neighbors. With his quickness to stand up for anyone who's hard done by, he has won the hearts of difficult, tough-minded old workers. From the age of 10, however, he has known the darker side of life. His father drank too much and brutally abused his wife, his son, and his daughters. About 2 years before the war, he walked out on them. Anatoly then left school, where he had been a star pupil in all subjects, and went to work at a factory in Kazan. On March 29, 1942, he received his call-up papers. He asked to be sent to sniper school. "I never even had a slingshot when I was a child," he said. "I didn't want to hurt anything living, and so I got off to an excellent start in every subject except target shooting. My first lesson was a disaster. I scored 9 out of 50. "It's no good, my boy," said the lieutenant. "The one thing you can't do is shoot." But Chekhov was not discouraged. Instead, he studied night and day. He read theory and examined weapons for hours on end. He had great respect for theory, and he believed in the power of the book. He soon had a perfect grasp of the principles of optics and could expound the laws of the refraction of light as clearly as any learned physicist. He understood real and virtual images. He could trace the complex path of a ray of light through the 9 lenses of a telescopic sight. He knew the theoretical principles underpinning every piece of optical equipment. He knew how to use the elevation knob and understand the relationship between the base reticle, which rises slightly as you take aim, and the horizontal reticles. The lieutenant instructor could not have been more wrong. When it came to firing at a moving target, Chekhov hit the small, skittish figure dead center with all 3 rounds. After graduating at the top of his class, he volunteered for the front, but was kept on as an instructor to teach students how to handle not only a sniper rifle, but also an ordinary rifle, a submachine gun, and the different types of grenades. Both at his school and the factory, Chekhov had mastered a variety of subjects and disciplines. He did equally well at sniper school. This young man, whom everyone had loved for his kindness and devotion to his mother and sisters, who as a child had not used a slingshot because he didn't want to hurt anything living, felt impatient to go to the front line. "I wanted to be directly involved," he once told me. "I wanted to be destroying the enemy with my own hands." When Chekhov was issued his first sniper rifle, it was late in the afternoon. He thought for a long time about where best to position himself, in a cellar, on the ground floor, or amid a heap of bricks blown out of the wall of a tall building by a high explosive bomb. He painstakingly examined the buildings in the front line of our defense. The windows hung with burnt scraps of curtain, the twisted and matted coils of electric wiring, the sagging beams and girders, the shattered trifold mirrors, the charred skeletons of double beds. His keen eye recorded every detail. He saw bicycles hanging on walls over a chasm created by the collapse of five floors. He saw the glittering shards of green crystal wine glasses. He saw bits of hand mirrors, seared date palm fronds on windowsills, and warped pieces of tin that had been whirled about by the fire as if they were mere sheets of paper. He saw the city's muscles and bones, dense water mains and black underground cables now lying exposed. Chekhov made his choice. He went into a tall building and began to climb up toward the fifth floor. A few of the stairs were splintered, but most were undamaged. From landings with charred doors, he could see into the building's empty shell. The different floors could be told apart only by the different colors of the walls. The second floor apartment was pink. The third was dark blue. The fourth was pale green with a brown border. Chekhov went up to the fifth floor landing. This turned out to be just what he wanted. The front wall had collapsed, opening up a wide view. There were German-occupied buildings diagonally opposite to the right and a broad straight street to the left, leading to a square about 700 meters away. This whole area was also in German hands. Chekhov took a position beside a section of the wall still standing, keeping well within its shadow. There was sunlight all around him, but he himself was invisible. He rested his rifle on the wrought iron railing and looked down. As always, he began by looking for orientation points, of which there were many. A shadow flitted across the cornice. A large Siberian cat passed by noiselessly, her tail fluffed up. She looked at Chekhov, her eyes glowing with electric blue fire. Somewhere at the end of the street, a dog barked, then a second dog, and a third. Then came an angry German voice, a gunshot, and a dog's last desperate howl, followed by more furious barking as faithful dogs tried to prevent German soldiers from looting their wrecked homes. Chekhov half got to his feet and looked down. Dark figures were darting through the shadows. Germans were carrying sacks and pillows to their building. He couldn't shoot, since the flash would betray his position. "Damn it," he said to himself. "Have our men gone to sleep?" In the morning, he got up before dawn. He didn't eat or drink. He just filled his water flask, put a few dry rusks into his pocket, and went up to his post. He then lay on the cold stones and waited. Day broke, bathing everything in light, and so great was the vitality of the early morning sun that even the unhappy city seemed to smile a wan, sad smile. Only where Chekhov lay was there a cold gray shadow. From around a corner below came a German carrying an enamel pail. Chekhov learned later that soldiers with pails always appeared at this time in the morning, fetching water for the officers. He turned the elevation knob, and the crosshairs in his sights floated upward. He aimed 4 centimeters ahead of the soldier's nose and fired. A dark spot appeared beneath the soldier's cap. His head jerked backward. The pail fell from his hands, and the man crashed down on his side. Chekhov was trembling. A minute later, a second German appeared from around the same corner. He was holding a pair of field glasses. Chekhov pulled the trigger. A third German tried to get to the dead soldier with the pail, but he didn't reach him. 3, said Chekhov, and he began to feel calmer. Toward the end of his first day, Chekhov spotted an officer strolling confidently down the street. As he passed by, some machine gunners hurried out of the buildings and stood to attention before him. Once again, he turned the elevation knob, and the crosshairs floated upward. The officer's head dropped back, and he fell on his side, his toes pointing toward Chekhov. Chekhov discovered that he found it easier to hit a man who was running than one who was standing still. He always got the runner right in the head. He also made a discovery that helped him to remain invisible. Realizing that what most often betrays a sniper's position is the flash from his rifle, he made sure that he always fired with a white wall behind him, keeping the muzzle of his rifle at least 15 centimeters from the edge of this wall. The white background rendered the flash invisible. He now had only one wish, to prevent the Germans from walking upright about the city. He wanted to make them crawl, to drive them into the very earth. And he soon succeeded. By the end of his first day, the Germans were running rather than walking, and by the end of a second, they were creeping or crawling. No longer did soldiers go out in the morning to fetch water for their officers. The path to the fresh spring was no longer usable. The Germans had to content themselves with boiling water from the locomotives. On the evening of the second day, Chekhov was able to say to himself, after pulling the trigger once more, 17. And that evening, the German submachine gunners had to do without their dinner. All night long, there was some ringing clatter of picks and shovels. The Germans were digging trenches in the frozen ground. In the morning, Chekhov saw many changes. The Germans had dug two trenches, one leading up to the asphalted street and one continuing beyond it. Evidently, they could do without water, but not without ammunition. "I've done it," thought Chekhov. "I've made you crawl." Then he saw a small embrasure in the wall of the building opposite. It had not been there the day before. Chekhov knew what this meant. A German sniper. "Watch," he whispered to the sergeant who had come to observe his work. Chekhov pulled the trigger. There was a yell, followed by the stomp of boots as the Germans carried away their sniper. He had not managed to fire even one shot at Chekhov. Then Chekhov turned his attention to the trench nearby. The Germans were crawling as far as the street, dashing across the asphalt, then leaping into the second trench. Chekhov began firing just as they emerged from the nearby trench. The first of the Germans dropped back out of sight. "I've done it," Chekhov said to himself again. "I've driven you from the earth." By the eighth day, Chekhov was in command of all the paths to German-held buildings. It was time for him to move to another position, since the Germans were now avoiding the area. He lay on his landing and looked with his youthful eyes at the city that the Germans had destroyed. As a child, he had not wanted to use a slingshot. He had not wanted to hurt anything living. But the iron, holy logic of the war for the fatherland had turned him into a merciless avenger. Next is a series of correspondence, the Epistles of Paul. From emails sent by L. Paul Bremer to his wife between August 2003 and June 2004, a period during which he oversaw the Coalition Provisional Authority, the governing body installed by the United States following its 2003 invasion of Iraq. This election was arranged by Nick Davis. August 8, 2003. "I am sure that pretty soon I will have a limp-wristed Brit in my office concerned about the waves we are making in their area of operation. Tough luck, boys. New game in town. We are not going to tolerate any more crime down there." October 3, 2003. "When I worked in the Nixon administration, the president was signing 500 letters a week to widows. Mitch McConnell said he knew that, but that our acceptable threshold of casualties was now much lower. I am not sure I agree, but that is his view." October 19, 2003. "The operation went well last night. Very little resistance, no American casualties, and we did not have to use air power. Our plan is to try to clear the mosque tonight. Everybody is going wobbly and coming up with his bright idea on how to change our strategy." October 29, 2003. "Colin Powell said we were going to succeed in Iraq. we would do the right thing irrespective of what the newspapers or political opponents said about it. Condi repeated her concern over the Army's panic attack. The president joked that I had been in Dick Cheney's class at Yale. I corrected him. We started in the same class. Good laugh all around. He asked me about my relationship with Rumsfeld. What kind of a person was he to work for? Did he really micromanage? I said I liked Don, had known him for 30 years, considered him highly intelligent. Clever, he interrupted. But he did micromanage. This confirmation seemed to surprise the president. I said that he terrified his civilian subordinates so that I could rarely get any decisions out of anyone but Rumsfeld. This worked all right, but was not ideal. The leaks have already started in Washington. November 15, 2003. My governance team is all depressed because we did not insist on electing the transitional legislature. Of course, that would have been preferable. It would have given all Iraqis a sense of participation in the political process in 2004. Under our plan, they won't have that until 2005. I have told everybody to buck up and face the facts that politics is the art of the possible. They'll be okay. November 18, 2003. Rumsfeld has sent me a note saying that now that we are to get another $1 billion in oil for food program money transferred to Iraq, we should set aside $60 million to speed up security forces. I have to remind him that we have already spent that $1 billion and more on keeping the Iraqi government going. I sometimes wonder if people in Washington pay attention when I tell them we are going broke. I note that articles in one of the papers today called me beleaguered, and it does feel that way at times. March 18, 2004. As you know, we had a big bomb go off last night at a little after 8 a.m. We have had the usual black information coming at us. The U.S. did it. A helicopter was heard overhead. The foreigners were warned to leave the hotel before the bomb, etc. Fortunately, no Americans were killed. March 27, 2004. The food was better, and at least Iraqi, though it is clear that the caterer is not drawn naturally to Iraqi food. He still brings along lousy Western-style bread, which I had him remove, and has not found a ready source of the excellent non-like Iraqi bread, but the event was a success in any case. The Marines ran into a big firefight last night outside Fallujah. Lost another soldier. I hope they are getting mad and will start to kick some ass out there soon. We are on a slippery slope concerning militia and need to act. I hate Saturday nights here. March 31st, 2004. Dick Myers and I had lunch with Robert Blackwell, who has just arrived. He reported that everybody in the White House is totally distracted by the Clark events. Also said that the sniping at me has diminished a bit at State, though not according to today's New York Times. Ambassador Francis Ricciardone is afraid I will become Secretary of State, so he is trying to ingratiate himself. Too late. We are not entirely in accord with what we understand of the Washington approach to the interim government. We couldn't very well give them a glass of tea and send them home. So there was an argument for some kind of a standing body, an assembly or a shura or something. It need not have any real powers. It need not meet often. But we had to think up some creative role for this crowd. When Condi called, I told her that my office was the Iraqi equivalent to the crying room at the back of a good Catholic church. All I need when someone comes in to see me is a big towel. April 1st, 2004. As I told Condi yesterday, we are simply not fighting this war anymore. The military is drifting around with no sense of strategy and very little sense of taking the fight to the enemy. So our guys get killed as they drive around towns, and we do nothing but round up the usual suspects, throw them into jail, and throw away the keys. We manage to look weak and vengeful at the same time. It is a recipe for failure. After almost a year, I confess to having a bit of difficulty grasping the essence of Yazidihood, but I do know they worship angels and hate the color blue. Further into their theology, I have not dared to tread. I don't mind the angels, but their attitude toward blue offends me. By itself, it is certainly more than enough to disqualify them from a seat on the governing council. I had a brief chat with Condi and had nothing for her. I am so mad I could spit. April 5th, 2004. The State Department is looking for ways to blame someone for the crisis, undoubtedly me. The Vice President's position is not yet clear. April 7th, 2004. Today has begun very badly. Just to keep us on our toes, it is clear to me that my team has not been able to stop the decline in gasoline inventories, which just keep going down. It will be only another week or 10 days before we add a gasoline crisis to the political crisis. April 9th, 2004. Thinking about the unthinkable. April 11th, 2004. You will see from the press that the backbiting about failure in Iraq has begun. It will be relentless from now on. Two long pieces critical of my tenure in the Post, a similar one in the Financial Times today, etc. Against my wishes, I did the morning TV shows today. The White House insisted because they have nobody else to go out and defend the policy. It's getting mighty lonely out here. April 16th, 2004. Dick called in from Fallujah. He's actually enjoying it because the sleeping accommodations are better than the trailers here, and he has nothing to do this morning but wait for the delegation meeting after prayers this afternoon. So he had a nap after breakfast, a brief R&R. April 27th, 2004. From all the reports coming in, we are losing the support of the Iraqi people who are fed up with the occupation and the lack of security. And that is our biggest failing, not providing law and order, and have gripes about the economy. We will be left holding the bag, trying to cobble together some kind of government under the most difficult circumstances imaginable. Quality Iraqis will not want to be associated with us, and the resulting interim government will easily be portrayed as a lackey of the still occupying power. Not a pretty outcome. The Blackwater doctor came in to look over my itches. He thinks it is likely they are bug bites. It certainly is not from gardening. He's going to give me some anti-itch stuff and has suggested a complete change of sheets and mattress because there are buggy things that may be living in there. Saddam spent 35 years tearing this place down, and we cannot expect to fix it in a year. April 30th, 2004. I can't tell the good guys from the bad guys anymore. May 7th, 2004. The Abu Ghraib story is just washing over everything back there. The reactions here have been less hysterical. Poor Rummy looks like a defeated man. I've sent him a note this morning saying, "Don't let the bastards get you down." Last night I received a letter from a Mr. Paul Hunt, who has the UN title Special Rapporteur on the right of everyone to the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health. He works in the office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva, and guess what? Is writing about how the coalition forces, by using indiscriminate force and preventing civilian access to the Fallujah hospital, are in fact not guaranteeing the right of everyone to the enjoyment of, etc. Oh my. We are working on a reply that is going to say, we are responsible for law and order, and we mean to carry out that responsibility. We do so in a manner designed to minimize loss of innocent life, but that is inevitable in war. I would love to add a footnote saying that, in almost 40 years in government, I have never seen a sillier title than his, but that would be impolite. It appears that bin Laden has put a price on my head of 10,000 grams of gold. I told Dan Senior that he could say I was disappointed, since this equates to only $137,000, whereas we have a price of $25 million on his head. May 12, 2004. My anniversary in Iraq today. What a year! We moved on to Abu Ghraib. The Governing Council had yesterday discussed tearing it down right away, so I started by noting that reopening the prison had been a difficult decision for me. I had agreed to it only after my advisors had scoured the country looking for another maximum security prison. There was none. So on July 1st, I agreed to reopen it, on the condition that part of the prison would be set aside for a museum dedicated to remembering Saddam's tortures. You are listening to readings from the July 2026 issue of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Ricardo Sanchez gave a good short briefing on the situation of Abu Ghraib. He apologized for the inhumane treatment and noted that the first trial will start in Baghdad next week. After he finished, I said that many Iraqis had asked me about this matter in the past 10 days. I've told them, and through TV, the Iraqi people, that this behavior was outrageous. It did not represent America. Those who were responsible would be punished under the law. This is a marked contrast to what happened under Saddam, when this kind of torture, and worse, was a matter of policy. Unlike that regime, justice would be done. The accused would face a public trial starting next week in Baghdad. If found guilty, he would be punished according to the law. I had a brief call with Condi again. I told her about the move on the mosque in Karbala and the discussions in Najaf with the Shia. I told her that the governing council was quite good on Abu Ghraib today, criticizing the Arab and Western press for ignoring Saddam's much greater crimes. I'd encourage them to speak out to this effect today. The president said it was important to have someone who was willing to stand up and thank the American people for their sacrifice in liberating Iraq. He said he did not expect us to pick a yes man, but someone who could be thankful at least. May 14, 2004. We would have problems with him, as we will with any truly independent Iraqi PM. June 6, 2004. A three-week war of liberation is not enough to shake off all that history of suspicion and dislike. June 21, 2004. Bahram Saleh was confident that in the long run, the American intervention here will be viewed as a great achievement. June 23, 2004. When I first visited Mosul 13 months ago, there was not a single policeman on duty anywhere in Nineveh province. Now there are almost 9,000. When I first visited, there was no economic activity. Now the retail stores and streets were bustling with activity. When I first visited, there were no courts. Now these were operating and dispensing justice. Time marches on. Speaking of which, time for bed. XXX. Now, under the category of fiction is Corridors of Madness from Satisfied Sarcophagi, collected short stories by Joyce Mansour, which will be published next month by City Lights, translated from the French by C. Francis Fisher. That evening, you rose from your lecturer's chair more heavily than usual. You put your steel-framed glasses back in the right pocket of your vest, your dentures, specially made for you to combat the subdued light and smoky air of lecture halls. The canines blind the first three rows, the bicuspids take care of the following rows, and the molars, due to the brightness of their blonde frigidity, immobilize the back of the room. Joined your address book in your left pocket. You ran one pomaded hand through your hair and looked for me vaguely. Nothing out of the ordinary so far. As usual, a song, punctuated by the drumming fingers of a whole row of medical students, kept me from following the lecture closely, but, led by your powerful and lazy lips, I slid between the hours on little bits of sentences. The semaphoric gestures of your arms helped me. They peppered your thought, so, despite the heat, despite the mess, despite the crazies and the parrots, you spread, disseminated, propagated knowledge on our unfathomable heads like a buttered knife on a beautiful slice of bread. There is no time for those who listen only to their boredom. I succeeded in capturing your attention by making a large and frantic gesture. "Wait for me in the car," I caught your words mid-flight. Even when you did not speak to me directly, I understood. I gave you a curtsy and got ready to leave. Meanwhile, you waddled with a dazed look of a boxer who'd received a kick in the stomach before a catatonic redhead seated in the third row between two nurses with unending knits and Manos high heels. She pretends to draw you in by inspecting the bottom of her bodice with the help of a toothpick. I picked up a newspaper, two empty bottles, and a cord that was trailing between the benches and, with a turn of the crank and two oriental-style movements of the hips, I tied up a handsome parcel. Nothing beats a big package or a pipe to compensate for decorations, makeup, and other lacks. I will wait for you in the car, I thought firmly. Even an audio engineer, ear pressed against the ultimate sound, could not have detected in my inner voice the famous hysterical note of a jealous woman. I was watching you from the corner of my eye. You sailed toward the door and my friendly order with a mysterious feeling of revenge, of worldly hypocrisy. A human pentagon without a message to send. Nothing in the world would make me miss those hours of waiting and tenderness that were your classes at Santa Maria, even if it meant joining the tightly packed rows of patients standing, unbuttoned, grimacing, chewing, hiccuping, sometimes even sobbing, but happy to listen to you. I let myself be dragged toward the door when it was my turn, a vague hymn rising from the orchestra. It's good to feel like dead meat in summertime. Not far from me, a blind man asked loudly if he was standing in darkness. Appendicitis in men, is it on the right or left? The man next to me spoke faster, more distinctly, and louder than any man his age or even twice his age. The soft clarity and cold of dusk fell on me like a soup. Yes, thanks to you, the day had meaning. I went out through the hallways, empty for the moment, and strangely long beneath the neon beams that ornament the ceiling. I drifted down some interesting steps. They seemed to have the power to free me from the double servitude of the broken escalator and the debilitating small talk of the elevator attendant. The last advantage of these beveled stairs. Only the sickly with small feet and the medical students with hospitalized hobnail boots could take them with impunity, so one could avoid meeting others in the corridors of madness. I was humming a little geometric tune. I was not unhappy. Since almost all the machines in Santa Ana were automatic, I did not have to worry about the escalator once I reached the upper floor. It retraced its steps like a legendary character, without morbid anxiety or mechanical suffering. Once on firm land, I turned to the right. I could have followed the edge of the red carpet toward the exit door, but I thought absentmindedly of your teeth. I did not notice the progressive worsening of the decorative mural. I thought of your dentition, the real one, not the one that steeps in water at your lecturer's desk. I imagined your damaged canines dressed in porcelain like the Marquis of Saxe, held together by metal threads, spinning, ceremonial, without visible supports or good gums. They were dancing before my eyes and preventing me from getting my bearings. You had lost several teeth recently, abutment teeth. Others take their shoes off quietly in the shadows of your palace, like concierges in their dressing rooms, and still, even without your removable ceremonial teeth, in case of boredom one can take out a fragment without touching the rest, made with magnetized neon and well-oiled rubber, you are by far the most seductive professor. A placard covered with beautiful writing indicated the direction toward the room of capillary executions. A stitch in my side, at once both moral and physical, made me open the door without hesitation, risking your anger, dear Dr. Jean, who does not like to wait and knows how to show it. I was in absolute need of calm. Reason cannot always be controlled by intuition, I thought, as I entered a vast room without a visible ceiling. Lumpy clouds flew so low they grazed the eyebrows. I quickly learned the rhythm and, as such, how to avoid them. A clever combination of head movements, like those of a Balinese dancer mixed with one watching a tennis match, and lying spread out along the wall like poppies in a priest's garden. 12 Waffen SS officers in night uniforms awaited death in a joyless and frustrated silence. Shampoo and style, I said to the pretty receptionist, aerating her thighs on her perch. I don't have any chairs open at the moment, she susurrated, gesturing to the SS with her bust and chin. These gentlemen have priority. She was not very amiable, but her garters blossomed gracefully on the reddish tiles of her flesh. We have priority, miss. Even in death, we have priority, said a condemned man with the softness of a muscle that gives way under the pressure of effort. I did not listen. Why resist the storm? My hair could wait. The Germans, melted into a shapeless mass, fearful and clumsy, seemed to have only one stripe on all their pajamas combined. The singularity fell like an empty hour when hope deflates. I put on my sunglasses and, in order to escape all voluptuousness, to banish any shiver of late pity, I gathered additions and multiplications, do knots and decals. I practiced yoga, inhaled cereal through the nose, notches in the wall, and Venetian dreams. I was sterilized by Hitler. A round of gunfire meant that I missed the rest of the story. The one-eyed Waffen SS, was he like that before the volley? I will never know how old the wound was. Fell at my feet, foaming like a camel. That's enough. To hell with flirtation. I am no longer interested at all in the receptionist's thighs. She clapped her knees to tell me the interview was over. I returned to the hallway at the exact spot where I left it. Soup time. Soup, soup, beautiful soup. Unconsciously at first, then more and more allured, moved, overtaken by these events, I followed the little shadow girl, who ran naked on the walls and ceiling, visible and invisible, and incidentally, on the floor in the hallway, which, ending in a cylindrical cell, spun around itself like a fairground torpedo. The little shadow woman, chubby from the start, was thinning out. Her fat, absorbed by osmosis, seemed to feed the walls and the blockwork of the strong room. A sign informed the visitor of the place's name, but not its purpose, and turned more and more quickly, spastically, with shrill little laughs and sighs of dead leaves. I left stealthily, taking care not to be snatched by unbridled tall walls. You, what do they do in the strong room? I asked the man squatting behind the door. Make lady jam, he told me, without taking his eyes off the newspaper. But you, he looked at me carefully, is it so obvious? What? Every day for 20 years, I have tried to enter that room. To see, I need to know what's at the end of the hallway. Maybe I am reckless. At first I would dress up. I cheated. I slid between them, those who enter and do not leave. They help me. I never succeeded, but I always tried, without really believing it always. I am not a mark. No, I am trying, that's all. Jean was waiting for me below. Well, still alive, he muttered, working on the car. I was surprised to find he did not interrupt my story. Judging from this tale, my dear, the institution that we are leaving this instant is a madhouse. He was laughing. All things considered, I prefer the Sorbonne. Up next, a poem titled Early 1984 by Joshua Beckman from A Guide for Making Fragments from Diaries, which was published in April by Wave Books. Dad got a new sled for me and Randy. It's great. My Aunt Darlene came and she got me an art set. I like it a lot. Sean came over and we played Monopoly. He won. We had Chinese food. I had a great time. I got my new handlebars. I like them a lot. Today I went to the YMCA. Jeff and Colin came too. It was fun. We went to my grandpa and grandma's house. It is in Florida. We went to Clearwater Beach. The water was cold. I got to play Trivial Pursuit with my family. We had teams. My team won. I went bike riding and saw an alligator. We came home from Florida. Today I was drawing and I had a lot of fun. I rode my bike all day long. It was a lot of fun. I saw my Aunt Libby and we had a picnic. I went to art and I had a lot of fun. I went to Hebrew school. I hurt my ankle. I met kids near my street. We rode bikes all day. The next piece is from the Harper's Archive, 1963. Love of Country by Adlai Stevenson. It is not easy to be a patriot these days. Not because it is difficult to love one's country. The difficulty lies with loving one's country in the right way. The love itself is profound and instinctive, rooted in our childhood discovery of the delights of being alive, the colored mesas and bright flowers of the desert, the rocky shores and pounding seas way down east, the aspens showering autumn gold on the slopes of the Rockies. It doesn't matter what your picture is. For all of us, it is home. The complexity of modern society makes the loving difficult for everybody. But here in America, we have some quite special problems that come not from our present, but from our historical inheritance. Some nations emerge from a pre-existing tribal unity. Some grow up within an already established culture, and some are forged by conquest. None of these roots was followed by America. Our people have come from every tribal group. From the moment of its birth, it was a land dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal, that government is a rule of law, not men, that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are man's inalienable rights. Consider the consequences of this astonishing start. We are Americans because we belong to a certain ideal, visionary type of political and social order. America is a political and moral fact. The first community in which men set out in principle to enshrine freedom, responsible government, and human equality. How easy it is, contemplating this vision, to see in it, as Jefferson or Lincoln had, the last best hope of man. To be a nation founded on an ideal makes our love of country a more vital force than any instinctive pieties of blood and soil. But it also demands a more complex and discriminating love. Will the fabric hold if the ideal fades? You may say, why be so concerned? After all, one of the most forceful elements of our free society is precisely our discontent with our own shortcomings. We know that between the idea and the reality falls the shadow, and we are determined to chase away that shadow in the uncompromising light of truth. But are we? It is at this point that our patriotism must be discriminating. All too often, voices raised in the name of super-patriotism denounce honest divergences as akin to treason. We have risen up from the pit of McCarthy's time, when honorable men could lose their jobs for questioning whether they were known communists in the State Department. But the intolerant spirit that equates responsible criticisms with selling the country short or undermining the American way of life is still abroad. I can give you no comfort in suggesting there is an easy way around this. Our position today is equivocal. We are in one sense a very conservative people, for no nation in history has had so much to conserve, to defend every abuse, every self-interest, every encrusted position of privilege in the name of love of country, when in fact it is only love of the status quo. That is the lie to which any conservative society is prone. We do not escape it, but with us, an extra edge of hypocrisy attaches to the confusion. Indeed, if the world's first experiment in open society uses patriotism as a cloak for inaction or reaction, then it will cease to be open, and it will lose its fundamental reason for existence. Do not, therefore, regard the critics as questionable patriots. What were Washington and Jefferson and Adams but profound critics of the colonial status quo? Our society can stand a large dose of constructive criticism. The patriots are those who love America enough to wish to see her as a model for mankind. This is not treachery, but the truest and noblest affection. No patriot so defaced America as those who, in the name of Americanism, launched a witch hunt that became a byword around the world. We have survived it. We shall survive John Birchism and all the rest of the super patriots, but only at the price of perpetual and truly patriotic vigilance. One of the regularly featured columns in Harper's is Findings, which I will read to you now. Farmland abandoned during the Syrian civil war has been rising. Neolithic decline and associated population replacement occurred in the Paris Basin, and the deliberate quarrying of stone began as early as 220,000 years ago in South Africa. Accelerating human evolution, coincident with the development of agriculture, increased redheadedness and decreased male pattern baldness. Cleft palates appear not to have been treated as shameful under the Qing dynasty. Buried Asunaro trees, along with the diaries of the courtier and poet Fujiwara Notika, allowed for the dating of a solar proton event to between the winter of 1200 and the spring of 1201. Japan's meteorological agency debuted the new category of Kokushobi, cruelly hot days. Between 1990 and 2023, summers lengthened by roughly 6 days per decade. The vegetation line is creeping up the Himalayas. Westerly winds in the Tasmanian Gateway and the Drake Passage gave rise to the Antarctic circumpolar current. Atmospheric warming is diminishing wildfires' nighttime lulls. The flammability of materials on the moon experiment announced its intention to burn various materials on the moon. The rise of the handshake did not precipitate the loss of hat doffing. People have been losing an annual average of 338 daily spoken words for the past 15 years. Large language models consistently prefer CVs written by other large language models, and specifically those written by themselves. Chatbots tend to not recommend voting for right-wing parties. In civil wars, intergroup conflict may be worse for mental health than outgroup conflict. Social conservatism among men, but not women, was negatively correlated with intellectual giftedness. A Utah philosopher argued that a meaningless universe does not necessitate nihilism. 92 antiprotons were transported 6 miles by truck. Negative time was experimentally confirmed. Tobacco plants were engineered to produce buflutinine, DMT, psilocin, psilocybin, and 5-MeO-DMT. Researchers discovered a mu-opioid receptor superagonist with weak addiction and withdrawal symptoms and high overall safety that also reduces heroin self-administration. PFAS were detected in dolphin milk, in the silicone leg tags of 90% of Argentine Magellanic penguins, and at rapidly rising levels in the livers and muscles of Svalbard reindeer. The Atlantic mangrove fiddler crab is expanding beyond mangroves. The sideways walk of true crabs originated with a single ancestor. Gibraltarian macaques are eating dirt to help digest junk food. Obesity-fostering bacteria were found to represent a plurality in the gut microbiomes of American black bears. I'll conclude today with a letter to the editor. It was written in response to Samuel Moyen's essay, The Old Guard, from May of this year. Moyen's article and the accompanying cover photograph showing old people as malevolent and evil were not up to the usual standards of Harper's Magazine. While there is certainly a problem with the ubiquity of politicians and business leaders of advanced age, Moyen misrepresents older people and offers solutions that are discriminatory against them. He believes that they should cede the stage to others and be divested of political power, wealth, and property, but guaranteed dignity and state support at the end of their lives. In other words, old folks should lose their jobs, money, property, and the right to vote, and throw their arms open to the mercy of the government. While he makes passing mention of the millions of older Americans living at or below the poverty level, he persists in characterizing the entire class as self-interested rich people. The problem in America is not that it has a rich class of old people, but that a few individuals, some of whom are old, have excessive wealth. Those wealthy individuals are the ones who own the government, not the class of old people. The article is peppered with words like doddering, wizened, and hoarding, words more appropriate to propaganda than a thoughtful article. I am 83 years old and live on a fixed income. I own my home, can budget for travel, am glad to pay taxes to support schools, donate money to causes that help disadvantaged people, and have saved up enough, I hope, to cover medical and other expenses as I grow older. I have a feeling that there are many more like me, as well as older people with far less, who are more representative of this country's elderly than the grasping rich whom Moyen describes. Bruce Warren, Los Alamos, New Mexico. Thanks so much for joining me today for this episode of Harper's Magazine on Sunsounds of Arizona. Today's readings have been from the July 2026 issue. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward, saying goodbye for now and hoping that you'll join me again next time.